Here's what I'd like to do. In about 10 minutes, we'll get to your questions. I'm going to offer a couple of thoughts, putting on my old CBO hat, the job I held 25 years ago when Jim Miller was effectively my boss back then, working with Les Aspin, as well as a number of other members of Congress. And we did some studies on the future cost of nuclear forces in the aftermath of the Cold War. I want to look at some of the budget numbers for the modernization strategy, and then work down the row one more time for anyone to offer any additional comments, either in regard to that or in regard to what they've heard from each other. We'll do all of that fairly quickly and then get to you. Let me offer the following. We saw in this document, and we've seen, I think, in other Trump administration statements over recent months, the constant reiteration of nuclear modernization as being the top priority, which was also the Obama administration's view, and often the comments that you would hear from Obama administration officials. I remember once we had Admiral Richardson, the CNO, here, and I challenged him a little bit in a friendly way as to whether that was the right way to think about nuclear modernization, and he said absolutely it must be, because our submarines are getting old. The Ohio-class need to be replaced. They're not going to be safe anymore. And what I'd like to propose to you is that we look a little more critically at the overall price tag of estimated at $1.3 trillion for the full modernization agenda. And I want to suggest we may need to prioritize. Right now, there are five, as I define them, five big categories of nuclear modernization in Trump administration plans, mostly consistent with Obama administration plans. There is the replacement of the SSBN force, the ballistic missile armed nuclear submarines, the Ohio class becoming the Columbia class. There is the B-21 bomber, the Raider, being built. And that, among all these capabilities, has dual purpose, conventional as well as nuclear. There is the desire to replace the Minuteman ICBM force. Even though it's been around for a long time already, there are some questions as to how much longer it could remain in effect. There is the nuclear command and control that Jim and others have talked about, being seen as vulnerable to cyber attack, to nuclear attack, just getting old itself. And then finally, the whole Department of Energy nuclear weapons infrastructure question. I would like to put forth a very simple conceptual point. First of all, that I'm not persuaded by the math that I see in the NPR. It claims that this entire agenda will never lead to a higher percentage of the defense budget for nuclear modernization than about 6.5%. I think that's a very low estimate. When I do the math, I come up with a number closer to 10%. And that doesn't even include Madeline's domain of the nuclear weapons activities of the Department of Energy, which are, when you add up cleanup and everything else, close to another $20 billion. So this is real money. And I think right now there's a little bit of a giddiness in Washington. The defense budget is more or less fully funded robustly across all domains. I don't think that's likely to be the case. So I think we need to start to prioritize and at least have a debate about which of these five areas of modernization are most important. To my mind, there are three that are clearly more important than the other two. That's my own analytical judgment. Others may disagree on this panel or among all of you or elsewhere in town. But I think clearly we do need to replace the nuclear armed submarines. They're getting old. They're not going to be safe for our sailors that much longer. They're already pushing 40-year service lives, which is far and away the longest we ever operated a submarine in the United States. So I fully support, you can debate the numbers and the specific details, fully support replacing the Ohio class with the Columbia class.
Michael, if I may, they're Please. Also the most survivable strategic system.
So another.
They carry the bulk of our strategic warheads.
Right, thank you. I also fully support the B-21 Raider, because I see it as being so useful for conventional warfighting. It is one of our asymmetric advantages in conventional warfighting, long-range stealth bomber. You'll recall we already have a stealth bomber, but we've only got 20 of them in the B-2 force. And any kind of large-scale deterrence of large-scale conventional conflict, I think, is going to require substantially more long-range stealth than that. So for me, the overwhelming argument for the B-21 is the dual capability of that platform. And I'm very glad to see that it's, at least at the moment, robustly being funded. Finally, nuclear command and control. And with Jim Miller here, I could have mentioned his affiliation with the Defense Science Board. A year ago, the Defense Science Board put out a report that I still lose sleep over occasionally, because it talked about how we really couldn't vouch for the cyber resilience of any of our nuclear systems. It didn't go so far as to say they're all vulnerable to being taken down tomorrow by hackers, but it said there are questions about basically all of them that we're going to need a decade to remedy. And so to the extent that we can't vouch for the integrity of our nuclear command and control, that's got to be seen as a top-tier problem. The DOE, we've already heard a lot of questions and criticisms, or at least, you know, doubts about some of the more ambitious planning there. And finally, on the ICBM force, I think we can probably delay it the way that RAND, the way that GAO have examined, by finding a way to shrink it somewhat so that some of the existing deployed missiles become a repository of test missiles, because there's a certain number of test flights you have to do per year. If you do a combination of refurbishment of the Minuteman force and a modest downsizing, I think you can maybe buy another 5, 10, 15 years before you have to replace it. In any event, if resources get tight, I think we need to have these kinds of options in mind. So it might be nice to do all five. I'm not sure we're going to have the funding. That's my little sermonette for the day. And so now, without further ado and without any more questions from me, there's a lot on the table already. I'm just going to ask my colleagues up here to offer any further thoughts they'd like before we get into the discussion. And we'll just work down the row, starting with Madeline.
Well, the one thing you forgot is also the Joint Strike Fighter. So the F-35 also has an important role in terms of being the dual-capable aircraft for delivery of the non-strategic warhead. So again, like the bomber, it has two very important missions, both the, you know, primarily dominated by the conventional side. But again, it's part of this mix. And as you mentioned, and probably one more you forgot. At some point, we're going to have to come back around and do something with the D-5, which is the missile that's on the Columbia class and that will then transition, or on the Ohio class and will transition to the Columbia class. So at some point, it's going to have to go through a life extension. And then in addition to all of the physical infrastructure at NNSA, there's also the physical infrastructure at DOD, which is also not discussed very much in the NPR, other than I think there's a very quick mention of the modernization of the silos themselves for the Minuteman III/Minuteman IV. And then the other large problem out there is you also have a people infrastructure that really has to be paid attention to. As we transition from a period of time from the Cold War where there was testing of some of these warheads to a period of time where we've made the handoff for the most part from the folks who had testing experience to the scientists and engineers now who are taking it forward. And the next big transition will be when they hand off to that next generation. And to do that, we also have to have a significant investment in long-term science and engineering for stockpiled stewardship. And that's not very well laid out in the NPR as well. And then finally, as we get rid of the 40 to 60% of these old buildings across both the DOD and the NNSA complex, we have to pay to get rid of them. And that's another big unpaid bill. So, I mean, I am in complete agreement with you that some of these rough estimates, the $1.3 trillion, all of this are pretty low.
Thank you. Jim.
Michael, I agree with your concern about the cost associated with the nuclear programs writ large. At the same time, I fundamentally agree with what Secretary Mattis said, as David paraphrased at least, which is that we can afford survival. I'll put it differently. We can't afford not to invest in the national security that we absolutely need. No one else is going to take care of our nuclear deterrent force. In fact, our nuclear deterrent forms a nuclear umbrella for key allies and partners around the world. So if it's 7%, if it's 10%, that's an acceptable price. It doesn't mean that any nuclear program, let alone all of them, should get a free ride. You probably remember that Secretary Gates, when he was secretary, did a hard scrub both of the Columbia-class SSBN and of the B-21. At one time, he canceled the program. It took us over a year and a half to come back with recommendations for a new program that was believed to be, and let's hope it is, more cost-effective. So both within programs and across programs, we need to be asking those questions. My own view is that although the department has concluded so far that the most cost-effective way to go forward with an ICBM leg is to modernize, that you're probably right that if one takes down the overall size of the force a bit from the 400 deployed today to a somewhat smaller number, that one could buy time. I'll say my own recommendation in that regard is not going to save a lot of money, because I believe the most important role of the ICBM leg of the triad is to hedge against any future problem with the submarine leg. Don't see it today, could see it 20, 30 years down the road. So a hedge program that includes some research and development on potential mobile options for a future ICBM, to me, makes more sense than putting a whole bunch of hundreds more in silos in the near term.
Thank you. Bob.
Having a sustainable deterrent requires very broad domestic support. this NPR, the Trump NPR, builds on what President Obama did. President Obama actually had a very robust modernization program, and the Trump administration follows that. Where the Trump administration departs, where it's less continuity than change, in some areas that I think will raise questions about the ability to sustain that national consensus. The idea of new nuclear systems, a declaratory policy that suggests that the U.S. is prepared to use nuclear weapons in a wider range of circumstances. I think these will create challenges for building that kind of national consensus. And I think it's important that the administration do more to build that broad support, including a number of panelists have suggested in the area of arms control in particular. There are easy things that could be done, simply agreeing to what the Russians have apparently proposed, which is a five-year extension of New START. I think, Dave Trachtenberg talked about this earlier, and the administration, you know, will have to try to keep this consensus together. But it will be a challenge with the current NPR.
Thank you. And finally, James.
So, as some of you may know, a pre-decisional draft of the Nuclear Posture Review leaked in the Huffington Post a few weeks ago. And you can compare the original draft to the published version. The single most interesting change, in my opinion, was in the letter from Secretary Mattis at the beginning. And in the draft, it said that nuclear modernization was, quote, the top priority of the Department of Defense. And in the final version, it is a top priority of the Department of Defense. And you don't need to have served in government to understand, which I haven't, to understand that the difference between the top priority and a top priority is a very significant difference. And the fact that this change was made in the letter from the Secretary of Defense himself, I don't know who made the change, but I would hazard a guess that it was the Secretary of Defense himself that made that change, given that it was in the one, you know, the letter that was signed by him. If I'm right about that, and I have no idea if I am or not, that suggests to me that your assumption that, you know, there will have to be trade-offs made in the nuclear budget, I think is exactly right. And if there are trade-offs made, then I totally agree with Mike about where those should be made. Let me just say one thing about nuclear command and control, which is an area that I'm worried we're shortchanging at the moment. For me, it's kind of balmy to be looking at a third and fourth low-yield nuclear option. And that's what the low-yield SLCM and the sea-launched cruise missile are. They will be the third and fourth low-yield options. When we acknowledge we have a vulnerable command and control system on which everything depends. The fundamental challenge, I think, with command and control today is that so many of the US assets for command and control are dual use. They're used for both conventional and nuclear missions. The advanced extremely high frequency satellites, communication satellites, would be used to transmit execution orders to nuclear forces. They're used by special operators. They're used by ground forces. They're used by naval forces. So, you know, the other side may have an incentive to attack those in a war to undermine our conventional warfighting ability. And that would have huge implications for our command and control system. As an analyst at a think tank, I can come up with ideas for rectifying this problem cheaply. And as is very well known, every time analysts in think tanks come up with cheap ideas, they always work out that way when they're implemented in practice. There's never, you know, it's so easy to implement these ideas in practice. My sense is, in the current security environment, particularly in the face of developments in anti-satellite weapons and cyber weapons, actually building a resilient and redundant command and control system has the potential to be an extraordinarily expensive prospect. To my mind, that is the single biggest priority we as a nation face when it comes to nuclear forces at the moment.
Thank you. Okay, we'll go to all of you. Please wait for a microphone and identify yourself. I'll take about three questions at a time, if I could. We'll start here in the third row and then work our way a little bit backwards.
My name is Hans Kertner. I'm with the Transatlantic Center at the moment. No one mentioned disarmament. So non-nuclear weapon states would argue that the non-proliferation treaty has at least two legs, and one is non-proliferation, and the other one is disarmament, enshrined in Article 6 of the NPT. The NPR explicitly rejects disarmament in the context of the Penn Treaty. So what about your thoughts about disarmament and the NPR and the non-proliferation treaty?
Thank you. Let's see who's... I'll go to the woman in the red shirt, and then we'll come over here for the gentleman on the far aisle, and then back to the panel.
Susan Burke, formerly with the State Department. This is a question about low yield. As someone who's a veteran of multilateral non-proliferation negotiations, I think, notwithstanding this excellent discussion, this is going to be a really hard sell to the international community. But there seems to be a real focus on low yield as if that's somehow better. And I just would like some sort of comment on that. I've seen, you know, low yield as a Hiroshima-type bomb. Do we know what we're talking about there? Is this somehow better? And I think that is a discussion that's going on social media and so forth, is what exactly is meant.
Great, thank you. And then over here, please. I'll start with you, if that's okay.
Thank you very much. My name is Rafael from the Brazilian Embassy. We have heard a lot on the rationale for the NPR regarding other nuclear powers or American allies. But I would like to hear, please, some comments on the impact of the NPR on other countries and on the future of the non-proliferation regime. Since we understand that the nuclear power countries are redoubling their bet on their nuclear arsenal, what is this message conveying to other countries? And lastly, regarding the CTBT, it's explicit in the NPR that the United States will not pursue its ratification. What do you think would be the future of this structure that we have for more than 20 years and is not in force? Thank you very much.
Great. So we've got a couple of questions on sort of warhead-related issues and then a couple of questions on broader disarmament strategy. Maybe I'd ask Madeline to begin, and whichever questions you wish, and each person can then comment on one or two.
Let me talk a little bit about sort of the CTBT and how it relates, I think, to the NPT and our commitment to Article 6. So the one good thing about this new NPR is that it does commit to continuing the moratorium, which is good. I don't think it was a surprise that there's no interest in seeking CTBT ratification from this administration. But to me, the thing that was most important and which had been swirling for a while is there is a stated commitment to the CTBTO and also to the International Monitoring System. That is hugely important in terms of making sure that the foundational abilities to monitor and to monitor testing will remain in place and will continue to grow. There's also a comment in there about support to the IAEA as well. So that, at least, I think in many respects tempers what isn't, what is frankly something that was expected in terms of not seeking ratification of the CTBT. The two other big issues on Article 6 really get back to the change in emphasis on this NPR and the lack of significant focus on further reductions or really working to achieve zero and, with more emphasis on securing nuclear materials and making sure others don't continue with any terrorists or other development of nuclear weapons. So, yeah, I am concerned about this. But I think from a U.S. perspective, the most important thing we can do is get that five-year extension to the New START Treaty.
Secretary Miller.
Good. Let me start by strongly agreeing with Madeline about the importance of extending the New START Treaty, and that should be an easy, straightforward decision for the Trump administration and should be a priority. The United States has benefited not only from the reductions that we would have in Russian strategic forces without a treaty, but from the data exchanges that occur on a constant, on an ongoing basis every year, and on the 18 annual inspections that we're able to undertake. Significantly reduces the prospects for worst-case planning on both military sides. On the question of disarmament, It's worth noting that this NPR does say that the administration continues the long-term goal of a world without nuclear weapons. What it says is that goal looks further away, not closer than it did. I took it as a positive that it still included that goal. What does concern me, and Bob Einhorn articulated this well, is the subtle appearance of the expansion of the role of nuclear weapons in U.S. nuclear policy or U.S. strategy. It's below the top line. It's not the fundamental points of declaratory policy, but it does appear that there are elements of an expansion in attempting to deter additional attacks relative to what certainly the 2010 Nuclear Posture Review believed or asserted. That's important, but the bigger deal, again, to me, is not the difference between the 2018 Nuclear Posture Review and the 2010 Nuclear Posture Review. It's whether the 2018 Nuclear Posture Review reflects the view of the President of the United States, who has sole authority to direct the employment of nuclear weapons. On the question of yields, of the low-yield SLBM warhead in particular, Susan, there's no question in my mind that it's going to end up being much larger than the largest U.S. conventional weapon. So the U.S. is modernizing the so-called massive ordnance penetrator, the MOP, 30,000-pound weapon. We're talking about, I would guess, at the lower yields that they would contemplate, something that is hundreds of times has more explosive potential than the largest conventional weapon that we have. And if that is the case, I certainly don't see that it reduces the nuclear threshold. It may be a more credible response to nuclear use, and to the extent that this nuclear posture review focuses on that role of nuclear weapons, the fundamental purpose of nuclear weapons to deter nuclear use by others, I think it goes in the right direction. To the extent that it in any way expands that role relative to where it is or where it has been in the past, I think it goes in the wrong direction.
Thanks. Bob.
There was a question about the international response to the NPR. I think it'll be mixed, I think. Many U.S. allies and partners around the world will like the NPR. The idea of enhancing extended deterrence, countering possible Russian interest in initiating the use limited use of nuclear weapons. I think our Baltic allies, Eastern European allies, and our Northeast Asian allies will find a lot to like in this NPR. Japan is an interesting case. Just Japan is the only country that's been the victim of nuclear attack and has been a strong proponent of nuclear disarmament. But the day after the NPR was issued, the Japanese foreign minister came out with a very strong statement of support for the NPR. The Japanese relied heavily, in their view, relied heavily on the nuclear Tomahawk, the nuclear sea-launched cruise missile, and were upset when it was retired. I think they'll be very happy with the resurrection of this capability. I think the South Koreans also will see a lot to like. Many other non-nuclear weapon states, non-aligned non-nuclear weapon states, won't be happy with it. They'll be at least relieved that the administration retained the negative security assurance, the assurance that the U.S. will not use nuclear weapons against non-nuclear weapon states party to the NPT in compliance with their non-proliferation obligations. They'll be relieved by that, but I think they'll be concerned about the implication that the U.S. may be increasing the role of nuclear weapons in its strategy. The non-aligned have been unhappy with the slow pace of disarmament. Nothing in this NPR will change that, but I don't think it will qualitatively change that. It may give stronger support for the nuclear ban movement, but I don't think it's going to fundamentally affect the prospects for proliferation. I think countries don't pursue nuclear weapons because they don't believe that having them is essential to their national security. I don't think this is going to change that very much. James.
Thanks, Mike. Let me tackle both the questions that brought disarmament into the fray. As the questioner correctly pointed out, the document, the NPR, does reject the Ban Treaty, as did the Obama administration before it, and any US administration would have done. It doesn't endorse the long-term goal of a world without nuclear weapons. I think that was not a foregone conclusion that that statement would be in this NPR. Nonetheless, there's clearly a big difference in emphasis between the Trump administration's position on disarmament and its predecessors. Now, the logic of the Obama administration, and let me say this with some modesty, because the three people sitting to my right were deeply involved in crafting the logic of the Obama administration, and I wasn't. So, but you know, when President Obama in Prague renewed the US commitment to a world without nuclear weapons, my interpretation of what that strategy was is building upon the argument made by many non-nuclear weapon states that if you want us to do more on non-proliferation, you guys, the weapon states, have to do more on disarmament. And the effort was, it was a very kind of hard-nosed security-driven logic that by doing more on the Obama administration, by doing more on disarmament, the Obama administration was trying to catalyze a coalition to work on non-proliferation. It wasn't, as is sometimes claimed, that the Obama administration thought that if the US gave up nuclear weapons, North Korea would do so as well. It was that the practical tools we need to deal with non-proliferation, the more widespread adoption of enhanced IAEA safeguards, the more rigorous enforcement of export controls, of sanctioning countries that break the rules. Doing that required a political quid pro quo between disarmament and non-proliferation. Let me say two things about implementing that strategy in practice. The first one is that efforts to abolish nuclear weapons can be led by the US, but it can't be done by the US solely. The Obama administration was absolutely willing to continue negotiations with further reductions with Russia. The Russians had no interest in doing so. China won't even enter into a serious dialogue with the US about nuclear weapons and further reductions. Are there barriers to disarmament here in the US? Absolutely. Are there also barriers in other countries that sometimes get ignored when criticism gets heaped on the US? Yes. And secondly, I was really disappointed by the reception amongst many non-nuclear weapon states to the Prague speech. Not one single head of state, somebody of an equivalent stature of Obama, stood up and welcomed that speech and pledged to work with him. Not one. Standing up alone as opposed to in the Security Council. So, you know, it's not my job to tell non-nuclear weapon states how they would respond to the NPR. I would love to hear more from non-nuclear weapon states about their response to the NPR. All I would say is, you know, if in a future administration you want the US to take disarmament more seriously, I think the more that there is public support for efforts made by a US president on disarmament, and let's not forget how politically brave the Prague speech was, the more that that kind of effort is endorsed and welcomed by other states, the more chance there is to make it sustainable.
We'll do one more round here in just a second. First, I have two clarifying points or additional points. One, I think you've heard us reference the Prague speech. Of course, for those of you who may have forgotten, this was President Obama's April 2009 speech early in his presidency, really articulating the vision of a nuclear-free world at a time when it still seemed conceivable that we could make near-term progress towards that. Obama didn't have any utopian view that this could happen fast. I think he questioned in the speech whether it could even happen in his lifetime, but it seemed a more thinkable kind of concept back then, and that's why you've heard some people refer back to it, just for those of you who may not follow this stuff quite as much as some of us do. And then secondly, my own personal speculation on the low-yield warhead, without having been read in to have the kind of security clearances on this subject that would enable me to know the real answer and not be able to say it. So I'll give potentially wrong answer, but I will say it. And this is based on a lot of what's come out over the years from what we know about nuclear weapons design, writings by people like Frank von Hippel and Richard Garwin that I've tried to devour over my career. And I think the simplest way we can understand this, you know that modern American nuclear weapons are essentially two-stage. They're thermonuclear, hydrogen bombs. What that means is a first nuclear detonation, sort of in spirit like a Hiroshima or Nagasaki bomb, goes off. That creates the necessary temperature and pressure to then ignite the hydrogen fuel in the secondary. So you need a small nuclear burst to make a big one. the simplest way to take one of those weapons and turn it from a big yield weapon into a small yield weapon is to get rid of the secondary, or to contaminate the hydrogen fuel with something that's not going to ignite as much and not produce as much yield. And what I don't know, what I don't claim to even be able to speculate about, is just how much you can dial down the yield of that secondary sort of as you wish without particular new design or testing. But I do think it's fairly predictable that you could simply eliminate the secondary or render it inert in one way or another. And therefore, you could wind up with yields that are probably somewhat smaller. And Jim was hinting at this with the way he talked about scaling up from the Moab by a factor of 100 or hundreds, probably in the 1 kiloton range is what you could fairly confidently produce as a readily available weapon out of this kind of approach. That's just my hopefully informed speculation, not based on classified information, not speaking for anybody else on the panel or the NPR. By the way, one last thing. I'm going to make a personal note to thank Steve Pfeiffer. Steve Pfeiffer, he's in the audience today. He's been a person here at Brookings who's written a lot of nuclear weapons issues over the years. He will continue to do so, but from a sunnier perch in California where we thought he might already be today, which is part of why he's not up on the panel. But when we get to the end, I'm going to ask you to not only thank the panelists, but thank Steve. But we'll hold off on that until after the last round. So, yes, sir, in the back with the...
Thanks. I'm Jeff Price at Johns Hopkins SAIS. First, on the lower yield Trident, I think Bob Suver was quoted in Defense News as talking about primary only, so that's unclassified. My question goes to the crisis stability implications of effectively using a strategic delivery system for a non-strategic warhead or mission. There's a lot of ways to deliver a lower yield warhead in a regional crisis, and some of the questions that arise with the Trident in particular is this is in some way using your end game capability, your secure second strike capability at the beginning of a limited nuclear confrontation, and there's certain questions that I think the discussion needs to be had about whether that's, you know, the wisdom of that and the implications of that in a crisis, which is by definition a nuclear crisis.
Thank you. We'll see if we can take one or two more. A woman in the very back of the room in the aqua shirt, please.
Hello, my name is Alicia Dressman. I'm a nuclear policy specialist. I have a quick question for Madeline Creedon and then a question for Jim Miller. Madeline Creedon, do you see in the future an interoperable warhead LEP that would require modification of the physics package, knowing that right now they're focusing on the non-nuclear components? For Jim Miller, you mentioned road mobile ICBMs as a future alternative. Obviously, in the recent Air Force AOA, they canceled that option. Could you gauge qualitatively the hunger for a road mobile option, knowing, of course, that Russia just slashed that because they're broke, as usual? Thank you.
And I'll take one more before we finish up here with the panelists. So I'll go here to the fourth row, please.
Aaron Simpson, and question for Jim or others on the panel who'd want to answer. You put forward a reduction in the overall size of the ICBM force, and I'm wondering if you envision that as part of long-term arms control, or you would do that unilaterally?
So in this round, which will be our concluding statements, why don't we begin with James, and we'll give Jim the very last word since a couple of the questions were for him. So we'll go James, Bob, Madeline, and then Jim Miller.
Thanks. Let me just say a couple of talk briefly about the low-yield SLBM option, which, as I've already said, like, I think I'd much rather spend the money on bolstering the conventional deterrence around the Baltics. But there's two real operational issues I see with using a low-yield SLBM. The first one is you risk giving away the position of the submarine that the missile is fired from. Russia is rebuilding its constellation of early warning satellites. Those would detect a missile very shortly after launch, which would mean that Russia would know where the US Trident was fired from, which would presumably be a significant aid to Russia in hunting down US SSBNs. Now, if we're actually in a conflict where nuclear weapons are being used, it's not just a nuclear crisis, we're actually in a nuclear war by that point. I would think that keeping our most survivable forces survivable would be an incredibly high priority for US decision makers. So I actually think that if we were really in a nuclear war, the use of this option would not be an attractive one for the decision makers because, you know, there's such a high percentage of the really survivable warheads are on SSBNs. The second issue is the so-called discrimination problem, which is Russia could not distinguish between the launch of a low-yield Trident and a normal Trident, does that increase the chance that Russia would respond with a high-yield nuclear weapon before, or multiple high-yield nuclear weapons, even worse, before our Trident exploded and Russia knew it was low-yield, if indeed it does have the capabilities to determine yield rapidly after detonation? Now, this is a very complicated issue, which I'm not going to go into a huge amount here, because time is short. All I would say is there was a proposal about 10 years ago called conventional Trident modification. I know one person on this panel in particular probably still has multiple scars from that experience. All I would say is, and that was the idea that you would take some nuclear warheads off Trident D5 and replace them with conventional warheads. Congress decided not to fund that capability because of the discrimination problem. And that was not even a capability that anyone was talking about firing at Russia. This was the issue there was using this against Iran, North Korea, maybe China. No one was arguing for using it against Russia. But the discrimination problem was deemed so severe, even though we wouldn't be firing this at Russia, that Congress didn't provide money for it. I think now we are talking about a low-yield capability specifically for the use against Russia. So I think we have to take this discrimination problem seriously, even if, you know, the question of would Russia respond with multiple high-yield warheads as soon as it detected the launch of one of our Tridents is not that's a complex question to answer, and one that I'm not going to try to do in 5 seconds.
Thank you. Bob? I'm going to give my time to Jim because I want to hear his answers to Jim's questions about discrimination and about exposing the location of U.S. SSBNs.
Great. Madeline, before we hear that.
Thanks a bunch.
So I just want to emphasize everything that James has said. I mean, as hard as it would be to modify a W76-1 to have a low-yield option, maybe a primary yield only, the operational considerations are going to be much, much harder, and James has only touched on them. So that is a huge issue with respect to employment. And I'll just sort of add out there that, I mean, right now our D5 missiles all have multiple warheads. So when you think about this, are you going to have multiple low-yield warheads on a single D5? Are you going to mix them with other high-yield warheads on other, you know, the operational issues associated with this are extensive and extraordinarily complex, more so than the complexity of the warhead itself. So let me go to the IW. One of the interesting things about this NPR is I'm not sure there is any discussion of the Obama 3+2 strategy. There is a small discussion of interoperable warheads, but it has kicked it out for the future because under the Obama 3+2 strategy, sort of the next life extension up for ballistic missiles was going to be the IW-1. And it was ostensibly going to be a warhead that could be used on an ICBM and an SLBM, and it would look like something that would replace the Air Force W-78 and also the Navy's 88. The W-88, which is the warhead for the Navy, is going through sort of a rehab. It's not a real life extension, but it's sort of less than that. They called it an alteration, but it's think of it as a rehab. But it has extended the life. So as a result of that, the language in this NPR really talks about doing a life extension on the W-78. So in my mind, that means that we may have walked away from the initial 3+2 strategy and will retain 4 for a while rather than going to 3. Now, one of the interesting things that I would sort of throw out there for general discussion is maybe if there is real seriousness about thinking on low yields, maybe something that could be explored would be an IW down the road that would have variable yields, you know, so that you're not giving up, if you will, a strategic delivery platform, but maybe you look at something that looks like an IW with variable yields for both the SLs and the ICBMs. Again, way out there, way long term, I do think that this NPR walks away from the IWs in any, from the interoperable warheads in any near term thing, and has probably walked away from the 3+2 strategy.
So, Jim, we'll finish where we started. Over to you. Okay.
Thank you, Michael. Alicia, I have not seen a great clamor in the land for a road mobile ICBM. And indeed, I'm not arguing for that approach. What I do believe is that if you believe that the single most important role of the ICBM leg in a world where we have large numbers of weapons on the SLBM leg, our strategic submarine leg, then the most important role of the ICBM leg is to serve as a hedge against any problem with the survivability of that sea-based leg. If that happens 20 years, 30 years down the road, and I would not expect it to have any real prospect of happening any earlier than that, but it could in that time frame, then the answer of deploying more silo-based ICBMs or putting more warheads on those ICBMs would not serve strategic stability. So because of that, I think that a better program, even today, would be to go to a light rather than a heavier ICBM. The Minuteman replacement looks like it'll be about the same 78,000-pound missile as a Minuteman III. The old small ICBM was roughly half that weight, which gives it less throw weight, if we will, less capacity, but sufficient to have a single warhead plus decoys, and a more attractive candidate for going to road mobile. And to answer also Aaron's question on this topic, my recommendation, which also has not been met with great clamor in the land, including from the Defense Department, would be to go unilaterally to a lighter ICBM, to deploy perhaps a couple hundred in silos, to have them as necessary and when necessary to retain an ICBM leg, and then to have a research and development program and a demonstration program for road mobile. My guess is that that would cost about the same as going forward with 400 ICBMs in silos over a period of years. The cost would be somewhat later, which is useful, but most importantly, it would provide a hedge that we otherwise will not have, and it would be a stabilizing hedge in the event that SSBNs, our strategic submarines, became vulnerable 20, 30 years more down the line. On the question of crisis stability that Jeff asked, it's a good question. My view is that a low-yield warhead on a Trident, on a D-5 missile, is A, nuclear warhead, and B, a strategic warhead, and that one should not imagine that because something is lower yield, that it's going to be that will be known immediately by Russia or by anyone else, nor that it means it's not a strategic asset. So there will be significant and would be, I believe, significant hurdles, even above the hurdles that we should rightly have in employment of any nuclear weapon, because it's a strategic system. And I think my guess is for that reason that the administration decided it would also go forward with a longer range program to have a sea launched cruise missile that's again nuclear tipped. And let me just say that from my perspective, as a person involved in the Obama nuclear posture review, the reason for eliminating the TLAM-N, the sea launched cruise missile with nuclear tip at that time, was not that it was either destabilizing or inappropriate to have. It's that it was at, if not past, its end of life. And the question was, at that point in time, 8 to 10 years ago, should it be a priority investment of the United States nuclear posture to reinstate that capability, or were there far more important things? At that point in time, the judgment of the president and a unanimous recommendation from the Joint Chiefs, as I required as well, was that that system was not necessary and was not was not needed to fill a gap in extended deterrence in particular. I do think that calculation has changed with respect to North Korea and with respect to Russia. And at the same time, it's a 10-year program. So as Secretary Mattis has said, it also provides an opportunity for the United States to have a development program that could be part of negotiations going forward with Russia to A, stay within INF, and B, to put its tactical nuclear weapons on the table for serious negotiations, something that the Obama administration attempted and the Russians did not agree to pursue. I still believe that that would be a valuable next step, and the United States should continue to pursue extension of New START and to pursue negotiations on tactical nuclear weapons.
Fantastic. Thanks you all for being here. Please join me in thanking Steve Pieper and the panel.
Thanks, Steve.
While we're on the subject of U.S. military strategy, it's worth noting some of the contradictions that exist in American foreign policy. One example is the U.S. relationship with Turkey. This report is from RT.
Washington has admitted that some of the Kurdish forces it trains in Syria are shifting to fight against one of America's own allies. Turkey is currently on the offensive in northern Syria against groups it deems are terrorists. RT's Caleb Maupin has more on the tensions currently playing out in Syria.
U.S. Secretary of Defense James Mattis has confirmed that U.S. armed Kurdish forces in the SDF have been relocating to the northern parts of Syria to protect territory from Turkey.
The distraction of what is going on up in Afrin right now, which is drawing off some of the Syrian Democratic Forces. They see their fellow Kurds in Afrin under attack, so that is causing at least their attention to shift up there.
Now, the Kurds and Turkey are both key U.S. allies in the region. However, there's been tension between all three of them in recent months. Now, we've heard of how the USA has been arming the Kurdish forces and providing them with weapons. Now, Ankara has been quite upset by this action. They consider this to be the arming of terrorists. Now, at this point, we do have a statement from James Mattis confirming that he believes there are legitimate security concerns on Turkey's part about these Kurdish forces that have been armed by the United States.
We continue to work with Turkey on areas of disagreements, which is how do we take down ISIL as rapidly as possible. They have a legitimate security concern, and we do not dismiss one bit of that.
Now, there has been escalating tension between the United States and Turkey, especially in the aftermath of an announcement from the United States that it intended to create a 30,000-strong border force to protect Syria's border with Turkey. Now, U.S. leaders backtracked from those comments, but that hasn't stopped Turkey from being quite upset by these remarks. Now, we've recently seen the beginning of Operation Olive Branch, and this is Turkish forces moving into Syria to fight against the Kurds, two allies of the United States clashing with each other in Syria. As the tensions escalate, we're even hearing calls to rename the street on which the U.S. Embassy in Turkey's capital is located. There are calls to rename the street Olive Branch after Operation Olive Branch, the Turkish operation to go into Syria and fight against the Kurdish forces armed by the United States. There seems to be quite a bit of contradiction in the words and statements of U.S. leaders, and there seems to be rising tension between all three parties, the USA, Turkey, and the Kurdish forces.
Okay, to get a little bit deeper into this, I'm happy to say that Ahmed Al-Barai, Middle East expert, joins us live on the program. Ahmed, you're very welcome to the program. How do you see this now playing out? As our correspondent just described, the US is stuck, it seems, between a rock and a hard place. But is it one of their own making?
Well, the United States and Turkey do have a very contradicting relations across the past two terms of the presidents of the United States, starting with Barack Obama, who used to say that Turkey is their indispensable ally in the Middle East. But if you look at the policies on the ground, you would understand that there is a kind of more divergence of interest on the ground, especially when it comes to Syria and the Middle East in general. So the non-interventionist policy of the Barack Obama was a kind of a trap to Turkey that it's going to be more embroiled in the quagmire of Syria. And later on, when Donald Trump came into power and tried to mend these kind of relations, he just followed the footsteps of his predecessor, Donald Trump, when it comes to Turkey, and he continued with the support of the YPG. Now, both presidents, they do claim that they're supporting the Kurdish militias for the pretext of fighting terrorism and Daesh, and they are the only fighting groups on the ground that is able to fight Daesh, and according to them, they succeeded. Okay. But for Turkey, this is an existential threat that they cannot abandon easily. They do believe that the YPG is still an offshoot of the PKK, that is a terrorist organization that will pose a major major threat to their national security.
With what you said about Washington, bearing that in mind, can America therefore really continue to stay on the right side of both Turkey and the Kurds?
I don't think so. I think this kind of conflicting standpoints of Washington will lead eventually to a complete departure of Turkey from the orbit of the NATO and the United States, and will lead more to a closer relationship with Iran from the one hand, with Russia from the other hand, from Central Asia and Asia from the other hand, because what Washington is doing is a complete disregarding of Turkey's national interest and geopolitical interest in the region. That's something Ankara cannot easily accept.
Okay, ISIL, as you know, is no longer a military force there, but new conflicts do seem to be emerging. Like, the picture is widening. You've got Turkey, the Kurds, Syria, Israel, all involved in one way or another. Could this be the beginning of a larger scale war in the Middle East, or at least a conflict, not against a terror group?
Well, you know, the quagmire of Syria started with a kind of proxy war, then it moved to more involvement of these regional and international powers. Now, I think that the standoff is going difficult, particularly between the United States and Turkey, basically when it comes to the Kurds in Manbij. Now, the Afrin operation, it seems that with the green light of the Russians, the Turkey has the power to go ahead with the operation, the ongoing, though it's so far, it's difficult, and it seems that the Kurdish militias did have heavy weaponry. They're the guerrilla fighters, so the fight is not going so easy, though Ankara is still determined to go ahead with this operation. Now, the big elephant in the room is Manbij, and that's where the United States is still on the ground. They do have troops, and in that case, if they do not withdraw their troops and advisors from this region, then Ankara says, and repeatedly the president here threatens, that he is going to go ahead with this operation in Manbij because they don't want any YPG in the west of the Euphrates River. And in case this happens, I think there will be a kind of military standoff, and that could lead to more tension, if not a military standoff between the United States and Ankara, that could lead to a major escalation, to more wars on the ground. When Russia, Iran are on the same page with the Turks, that will lead to a more alienating and more isolating of the United States.
Yeah, and big ramifications from that as well. Ahmed Al-Barai, Middle East expert, always good to get your take. We appreciate it. Thank you.